Okay, so this is, we are finally in the last week of the series on apologetics. I know it's been like a month.
Were we supposed to finish before Christmas?
We were. And we would have if we didn't have the Christmas. No, would we have finished if we didn't have the Christmas party?
Technically, it's still before Christmas because Christmas is in
December. Yeah. Yeah, it's still before Christmas. But this is the last week of this series. Just to kind of overview some of what we've done, you know, I started off talking about sort of my personal experience with faith and experiencing a crisis and how I worked through it and the view that gave me of apologetics and what it should do and what it shouldn't do. Then we went through some of the classic arguments for Christian faith based on natural theology. Right, just arguing from nature. We went through a couple of the objections. And then we've been going through some of the historical arguments for Christianity. Right? And my general point in all of this is that I think the best way to argue for the truth of Christian faith is empirically, evidentially. So we're pointing out things that have happened. So all of, if you go back and listen to the classes, taking a look at the resurrection or the growth of the early church or prophetic signs, everything that I put forward as I think this is the best argument for Christianity is based on things that happen. Now we have to interpret those things, right? We have to have a framework to interpret those things that happened, but. It's less basing your faith on saying that I believe or sort of finding faith within yourself. And it's more based on looking at things that have happened and what's the best interpretive framework to explain all of these things that have happened, right? And that's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do this week. Except this is going to be recent history now. So everything, all of the evidential stuff that we've done up to this point has been ancient history, right? Up through the early church, up through the first, 3 or 4 centuries A.D., right? Which if you're doing Old Testament study, that doesn't feel ancient, actually. It feels close to recent, but it's still, I guess, ancient history, right? This week, the final week, I want to survey the growth of the church globally in the 20th century. Because crucially, I think, for us as Christians, it's within the 20th century that the church once again sort of broke out from being a product and contributing to one major culture, and now it's truly a global faith. And we'll take a look at it, but the pattern that we saw the last time we met, which was 2 weeks ago, the pattern that we saw 2 weeks ago when we met from the early church, I think has been reproduced multiple times throughout the 20th century. And it's made Christianity a truly global faith, unlike any other religion or faith today, right? So I want to before we get into it, there's two books that I want to recommend if you want to read more on this, right? And these are the main books that I'm drawing from. I mentioned this one at the beginning of the series, Craig Keener's Miracles Today. And this is the personal aspect, and we'll get to this at the very end, all right? We'll get to this at the very end. And then the other one, I don't have a copy. I actually have a copy in my study, Carol, but I didn't pick it up. It's by Mark Shaw, and the book is Global Awakening. And so I'm gonna follow a lot of what Mark Shaw has outlined as a theory of history in this.
Not everything, but a lot of it. Okay, so.
So last time we met, we looked at when we looked at how to explain the growth of the early church. There were some factors, right, that seemed to all work together, right, within this. So we had reports of miraculous signs, particularly connected to apostolic teaching, right? And this isn't just within Acts 2. It is within Acts 2, but it extends beyond that into the early church, right?
We've got coordination between local groups across geography. I'll just put geography here.
So we have local congregations that are working together, and the network not only maintains support of Christian work and Christian ministry, but it also kind of surprisingly maintains a unity of message, right? The message of the gospel, even though there's lots of other ideas floating around, the general character of the message of the gospel remains consistent throughout these different locales, right? Throughout these different locales.
We have social capital from virtuous living.
So this is people who are not Christians took notice of the different way that Christians behaved within that society, right? So it was clear to people around. One of the examples that I shared last time we met was there in a particular area, a plague had run through, right? And the general response from the population in the city was to flee, right? Get away from the plague, avoid it like the plague. That sounds funny now, doesn't it? but the Christian response was, instead of fleeing, the Christians in that area gained notoriety by actually going in and caring for the people that were sick. And it put them at risk, right? It was a life or death decision for these Christians to provide care. But crucially, they were the only ones providing care at that time, right? And it was those kinds of things. Christian care for babies that were left out to exposure, right? The Roman practice of leaving babies that had some sort of mark or deformation or something like that. You know, like, what would be an example? Like cleft palate or something. That would be seen as an ill omen. And a baby born with cleft palate would be left on a hilltop to die, right? Because you don't want to have that ill omen in your household. Well, Christians gain fame from going and taking those kids and caring for them, raising them, right? That is social capital. And then finally, martyrdom. So Christians who maintained their faith and maintained a sense of dignity throughout economic persecution, incarceration, and even execution, right? These kinds of stories, particularly the execution stories, and how Christians maintained dignity and courage through that time. This is Tertullian from the 3rd century, writing in Carthage, sort of in the middle of one of the centers of persecution, his famous statement, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church," right? Meaning that the reputation that Christianity got through the character of these martyrs commended the faith to people outside of it, right? So that's the social capital. And then the fourth is you've also got family growth. And I think this will be significant for the 21st century. I'll talk about that briefly at the end of this, but I think this will be significant for the 21st century. So this is all of these factors are pretty broadly accepted by historians of the early church as things that were factors in the growth of the early church, right? And remember, it grew. We know that it grew from a small band of, a sect of Judaism to within three centuries was the majority religion in the Roman Empire, right? So just almost unthinkable to have that kind of sustained growth in the face of persecution that is coordinated across government and societal lines and family lines, and just to sustain that through that amount of time that's why I suggested to you all that this is that keeping these things together are particularly the Christian response to mortal danger, the coordination between groups, and then obviously the miraculous signs and wonders that accompanied proclamation of the gospel. That though, to me, this is where the Spirit's working, right? Like if we're trying to discern where is the Spirit working in history, it's this, right? And we can see where it has happened, right? So this is the model, right? This is the model. And the interesting thing about this model when it comes to the 21st century is, and this is what Mark Shaw argues, is that this model in broad swaths, right, has been reproduced multiple times in different countries, different geographical contexts around the world, right? So let me give you some of the places where we've seen this happen, okay? And we can talk a little bit about this. Okay, we've got Korea. This Adobe Digital Editions is really buggy. Okay.
It's okay. We can see that we can send the light.
West Africa, particularly Nigeria. We've got Southern India, and we've got East Africa, particularly in Uganda. I'll just put America here. And we're particularly here thinking about the Azusa Street revival, the charismatic revival at the turn of the century. So I'll put Pentecostalism.
We got Brazil. We got Southern Africa.
You should have just wrote Africa.
Yeah, but these are all distinct revival movements.
See, Northern Africa, whatnot.
South Africa and
China. Southern Africa, South Africa.
All right. Okay. I'm going to close that program because it's annoying me. Okay, and we can also add to this, this wasn't covered in Shaw's book, but there's been enough reports that I think we can add this in. In Iran, there are plenty of reports of revival that is happening along these same lines, okay?
So, and these are all like in the 20th century?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, these are all 20th century. Oh, and also recently, sort of spilling over into the 21st century, Nepal. We've actually, our church supported Bible translation in Nepal. It's the reason Bible translation was targeted to Nepal is because of the growth of the church in Nepal. So that's sort of spilling over into the 21st century a little bit. But all of these places are areas where there we have seen these same reports of miraculous signs, local groups. Right, local leaders, not mission groups coming in, but local leaders who are coordinating this church growth, social capital, promoting growth within the society, and then moving forward. There's not enough time to sort of judge family growth necessarily, but I think if you'll see here, given population estimates and population growth estimates, you see three separate revivals within Africa. I'll sort of I'll signal where I'm going to go at the end. I really do think by the end of the 21st century, Christianity is going to be an African religion. It's not going to be a Western religion. It's going to be an African religion. So that's what most people who are looking at the trends. Another guy to read on this is Philip Jenkins. He's from Baylor. That's kind of where it's headed, right? I think this is the argument for the truth of Christianity, actually. I know it almost seems too easy to say Christianity's true because there's more of us. but when we take a look at the pattern that's been reproduced in these different locales, you know, any one revival is not enough to say, oh, of course this is true. But when you add it up, it seems kind of odd, right? That this pattern continues to repeat with similar results, right? Not obviously not exactly the same. And that's not to say that the church is perfect in any of these areas, right? There are lots of excesses and problems with churches in each of these areas. But the overall pattern sustains, I think. So for instance, in Korea, about the time of the Azusa Street revival, at the turn of the 20th century, there was revival. I think actually, at one point, I didn't verify this in the book, but I'm pretty sure at one point, Pyongyang, you know, the capital of North Korea at the moment, was called like the Jerusalem of the East because of the revival. Now, obviously, the division of the country has turned North Korea into a different place, but there's still a burgeoning underground church in North Korea, right? But some of the biggest and most influential churches in the world are in South Korea, right? And we're talking about a place that had no Christian presence, basically, at the beginning of the 20th century, right? And now in South Korea, there are churches that claim, you know, over the course of a weekend to cycle through tens of thousands, 100,000, 100,000 members, and, you know, through prayer services, and, you know, it's a, think about within 100 years, within actually less than that, within probably 70 years, 80 years, you go from having no church presence to the church in South Korea occupying at least a third of the population, right? At least a third of the population. And it's accompanied by these things, right? It's essentially a revival movement, right? Same way with Nigeria and Western Africa. You have a revival movement that lifts up lots of local church groups, right? Local congregations, and now Nigeria is, I mean, it's the seat of a of lots of conflict because it's kind of on the line between for sub-Saharan Africa and the Sahel. So if you all pray for peace in Nigeria, right? And in Western Africa. But that's another area where there was no church presence, and now there are maybe on the order of 100 million Christians in Nigeria.
Wow.
Right? I mean, it's not exaggeration to suggest that there are as many Christians in church in Nigeria as there are in America on any given Sunday, right? It's not hyperbole to suggest that, right? Southern India, I haven't read extensively on this, so I don't want to give a whole lot of details without knowledge. But particularly in Southern India, the church has seen a lot of growth, right? Now, in areas sort of in northern India, not so much, right? Not as much. There's still a lot of pioneering evangelism to be done there. But southern India and also northeast India. So the part of India, like if you're looking at India on a map, the part of India that is on the eastern side of Bangladesh. You know, there's like that little land strip between Bangladesh and Nepal. And then you cross through that, you're in far eastern India. There's actually the church in some of those states, the church is actually majority of the population there. Believe it or not. You got the East African revivals, particularly in Uganda. Some of those are tied to Pentecostalism in America. We've talked about that. I don't want to rehash all of that, but we got the same kinds of things. Reports of miraculous signs. We got various groups, local groups that are unconnected through any sort of hierarchy, networking together. it's overturning things that were seen as social wrongs, right? Not that there's not excesses, but we have that same form in Brazil. Brazil is within Latin America. Brazil is the heartbeat of sort of evangelism and charismatic revival, and a lot of it is occurring even amongst so evangelicals are growing as a percent of the population in Brazil, and it's also affecting the Catholic Church. And there are renewal movements within the Catholic Church all throughout South America, right? That's a lot of the same form. Southern Africa, particularly South Africa, if you all are familiar, I'll just write this down too. You can look this up. The Lausanne movement is a broad Christian movement that sort of started in South Africa. And when we're talking about the International Day of Prayer, all of that, it comes from South Africa now. So a lot of the coordinated global prayer movements were centered in some of the revival movements in Southern Africa, okay? The one I want to sit on, though, for a little while
The one I want to sit on, though, for a little while is China.
Because the story of China is, and the church in China is pretty amazing. Now, I do have, I don't think I have that pulled up. So, just recently, I saw in The Economist, so not a Christian publication. I don't have the article up right now, but in The Economist, it noted that that in particular in the last few years, the Chinese Communist Party, as an attempt to consolidate its power of the nation, is giving once again particular attention to persecuting and stamping out expressions of Christianity within China. Right? Now, that's interesting. Why would the Chinese Communist Party feel the need to tear down churches, to take crosses off of buildings that are used for worship, right? To jail local church leaders. Why would they even feel the need to do that? Well, the reason is because most estimates have the number of Christians in China somewhere north of 60 million. All right? Somewhere that, and it's tough to get official figures, right? It's tough to get official figures. But the most recent study out of Notre Dame gave the estimate somewhere between, you know, it's a wide range, right? But if you take the middle road, it's somewhere around 60 million, right? Somewhere around 60 million. Now, what's really interesting about that? If you remember, the Cultural Revolution in China, which led to Tiananmen Square and all of that, right? One of the things that happened in that Cultural Revolution was a systematic persecution of the church in China, right? And an expulsion of all missionaries, right? So you expel all missionary work, you put forth a policy of systematic persecution in China. And so in the 60s, the estimates were maybe there's 1,000 Christians in China, right? So if you remember, in the early church, the number that we had to explain, the numerical growth, was from, you know, 1,000 or so, maybe a couple thousand, a few thousand, a small group, right, in the first century, to about 35 million three centuries later, right? But in China, you've got to explain the growth of the church from 1,000, maybe a couple thousand, in 1960 to 60 million.
In a couple of decades.
Yeah, in the span of about 50 years. Yeah, Mark?
This is something that there was a church that I was a member of back in Colorado back, you know, probably 35 years ago, mm-hmm. maybe longer. And they sent a mission group. They weren't really allowed to be mission areas mm-hmm. at that time. They sent a group to China, and they had suitcases filled with Bibles.
Yeah.
And this is a report of miraculous signs. They could have been executed for having those.
Yeah.
And they could have been confiscated. And they actually went through a security check, and they opened all their suitcases. And for some reason, the guards were blinded from the fact that they were Bibles. They could not see them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they couldn't tell us where they were at or anything like that. But
yeah.
We prayed for them, and that report got back to us, and that was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were able to, you know, get
through. Reports of miraculous signs all over. Local church leaders, local groups. And listen, these local groups cannot officially organize, right? So it has to be all underground. Maybe you've heard about the underground church in China, right? And also, these people are seen to be good citizens. These aren't subversive elements within society, right? They're not trying to take down China or anything like that, right? This isn't anti-Chinese, right? So all of these things together are this is the report, right? And it's tough to get even if you go with the government estimates, right? The government estimates put the number of Christians around 30 million, right? So you're still having to explain maybe a couple thousand in 1950 to over 30 million, even by the government figures that are probably too conservative, right? You still have to explain that kind of explosive growth, and it's probably somewhere between 60 and 80 million, right? Yeah.
The other thing to factor in is the family growth. So they've had the one-child policy for a long time. What they're finding now is that the population is actually declining.
Yeah.
The ones who are having babies are those folks who are supposedly Christian.
Right.
Because they're the ones who understand that role of being a parent and having a family. So that's also helping that model sort of flip on its head as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so, in China, the church growth, I would submit to you all, follows that same pattern that we saw in the early church, except you're now squeezing the time period from three centuries down to half a century, right? And you still got that kind of growth, right? I would submit to you that within our lifetimes, we have seen the clearest example of the Spirit's move to promote the proclamation of the gospel that has ever been seen in human history. That's what I would submit to you all, is that if you're looking for evidence, right? If you're looking for evidence of Christianity, the confluence of revival movements throughout the world that fit this same pattern, particularly the growth in China, I think constitutes very strong evidence that God is confirming the message of the gospel and the proclamation of the message of Jesus around the world.
So are these like in order of in the 20th century kind of thing? The way you...
Broadly. I mean, the Azusa Street revival for American Pentecostalism was at the beginning of the 20th century. But Mark Shaw also, he ties in the evangelical revival in the 1950s under Billy Graham as part of that, is like a revival movement.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, so that's where it is in Shaw's book. So my conclusion is, this is why I'm still confidently a Christian, right?
Right.
Even pointing to all the things that are wrong with the church, even pointing to the ways in which Christians have behaved badly, even pointing to places where we have areas where we don't have good answers, or even, you know, pressing the problem of evil that we talked about a couple months ago now. in balance, it just seems like God's doing something. It just seems like God's working, you know, and as much as there are things that I don't understand, as much as there are questions that are hard, and even personally things that I don't understand in my life, right? It doesn't stand up to the weight of the dislocated revival movements that have spread the church and made Christianity really the global faith, right? The closest to it is Islam, as far as being a global faith, right? And it's close, but Islam still hasn't interpenetrated cultures in a revival way, the way that Christianity has in the 20th century, right? It's not too far off, but it's not there, and Islam has spread much more through family growth in the 20th century than revival movements. Though there have been places of conversion, but not quite revival movements like we see with Christianity. So, if God is accompanying... Oh, and by the way, we see this happening in Paul. Our church here has sort of coordinated with that. There's also in Iran, in a country that is officially closed to proclamation of the gospel, we have lots of these same kinds of reports, right? Miraculous signs, coordination between local groups. They have to stay underground, right? The social capital that comes with that is contributing to a burgeoning church, not just among Persians in Iran, right? People, sort of the majority culture, majority ethnicity in Iran, but it's spreading outside of even Persian circles within Iran, right? So I would submit this, particularly as China, as weight of evidence for that. And I would say that after having surveyed the global church, right, and seen God's work within the global church, particularly confirming the message through this pattern and through reports of miraculous signs, even though we don't live in an area that it calls for sort of pioneering evangelism that we would expect in some of these areas, I think it's okay for you personally to look at your life and say, God was with me in this instance, right? And so I think ultimately, looking at what God is doing around the world can give us confidence personally, individually, to interpret things that have happened in our life as God working in our life as well, to further the gospel, to further the kingdom through within our lives and our families and through our lives and our families, right? And that's what Keener's book does, is it compiles all of these stories. And some of them are things that could be coincidences, right? There's like a whole section on weather miracles, right? And you know, there's various ways to interpret what happens with the weather, right? But I think all of this combined together, especially when we consider all of the reports of healings that accompany proclamation of the gospel, other kinds of miracles, other kinds of spiritual encounters, power encounters that accompany proclamation of the gospel, I think it opens the door for us to also confidently say, particularly within our own personal contexts, to say, yes, God moved in our lives in that instance.
Yeah, I think it's funny, not funny, but like, you know, you looked at what happened down in Western Kentucky with the tornado,
mm-hmm.
and really all you hear of is all these Christian groups coming together to provide aid in some manner.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just goes to show you that even to, you know, through this day, those are still the things that are working.
Right. Yeah. And I think when we think about how do we grow Northeast Christian Church, I think this is the model, right?
Absolutely.
That's the model that we got to follow,
right?
So, you know, I don't think I'm breaking new ground in suggesting this to you all, right? I hope it's just clarifying what God has been doing all along. But I also think that in the last 100 years, or 120 years, God has confirmed this model to us in a way that we couldn't even have imagined, you know, at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, right? We couldn't even have imagined how the Spirit can work in different localities to build up the church in ways that lift up local movements that yet are still connected to the global church.
That's probably another memory moment, you know, during Hurricane Katrina and that other hurricane that hit Louisiana. There was billions of dollars of funding going in there that the government was gone with, but there were Christian churches all over. I remember Southeast Christian Louisville were building houses in the parking lot, and people were taking them down there. They said that Louisiana would not have been rebuilt if it weren't for the Christian churches down there and actually doing it.
Yeah.
You know, all the money that was sent there for relief just disappeared.
Uh-huh.
But I guess, like, you know, other than, like, bigger organizations like the Red Cross or something, you know, I guess an average person who's not affiliated or is not in a church, like, how would they get there to help? Or how would people organize in a way, like a church?
So that goes back up to coordination between
the groups
across
town.
We used to live in Northwest Arkansas for a while, and we were there during the Joplin, Missouri tornado.
Oh.
And I remember I was actually given a lesson that Sunday about bad things happening to good people right as that tornado was going through.
Oh, wow.
And almost the very next day, we were up there in tents helping. And it was interesting, the churches there, all the Christian churches, they were coordinated. They all worked with each other very tightly. They didn't care what church you went to. They just wanted to make sure you went to church. Mm-hmm. But when things like that happened, they reached out to their non-Christian neighbors and said, hey, we're taking a group of guys with chainsaws and trucks. I know you don't go to my church, but I know you like to use a chainsaw. Let's go. Right? And I know you got good camping gear because you and I have talked about hunting. And so there were probably as many non-church attending Christians there as there were Christians. Yeah. And they overwhelmed everybody else. I mean, the local government, the Red Cross didn't know how to handle it because there were just so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And they cleaned that place up in record time. It was crazy how many people were there just doing their own little thing. There's a group from Louisiana who just came up, and they just knew that all they knew how to do was cook. And so they had these massive kettles, and they would make all this food, and they would just feed anybody who would come by. And then there was a doctor who had a van, and he had this, was completely equipped out with medical equipment. His family knew, his little kids and his wife knew, that when there's a tornado, they were going to get in their van, and they were going to go wherever that tornado was.
That's awesome.
And they would go camp out, and he would just provide services and shots or whatever he could. And that was, so... It just, I think that key is, how do we sort of reach outside the four walls of our building, get coordinated with other groups, and go lean in on stuff like that? That's a miraculous sign of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, you know, a lot of times, out of these sort of tragedies, there will be a striking image, right, of a church building that's been destroyed through this, right? And you'll see the picture of you know, like the hymnal's still there or something, right? And say, what a miracle. Well, if this is right, right? If this is right, that's not the miracle, right? The fact that a hymnal's still there is not a miracle. The miracle is the church coming in to revive that community and different local groups working together as a coordinated whole to revive a community. That's the evidence of God's Spirit at work. And I would say that throughout the history of the church, that's how it's happened. You know, our church didn't grow out of the 20th century revival movement, but it was the leading indicator of the Second Great Awakening that turned this area from outlaw country into the Bible Belt at the beginning of the 19th century, right? So this is a pattern that we can track historically, but the 20th century, it exploded to make the church a global entity.
I knew when I got to Raccoon I was close.
Yeah, Raccoon John Smith. All right, so that's it. That's my case for Christianity right there. So that's it for the apologetics series.
Yay.
Anybody have any questions or thoughts or?
What's next?
Yeah.
So let me pause it here.